Well, welcome to another interview of Power Talk. I'm very excited today to have with us Dr. Bernie Siegel. In fact, he's given us the privilege of coming here on Sunday to his home in Woodbridge, Connecticut. Gotten to meet his cat, Miracle, and you'll hear his parakeet in the background. I want to really thank you for letting us be here with you, Bernie.
It's my pleasure, Tony.
If you're not familiar with Bernie, which I'm sure most of you are, he's just an absolutely phenomenal man. First thing I'd say about him, rather than all his accolades, is just what a loving human being he is. I think that's his power to heal. And as a doctor and a surgeon and a teacher at Yale, he's taken the lessons he's learned from his exceptional patients and been able to pass those on through his writings and through his speaking and tapes, and now you'll get the chance to meet him directly. Two number one bestsellers to his name, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, and his more recent book, Peace, Love, and Healing, both of which I hope you'll go out and get, and I'm sure you'll be inspired to do after hearing this interview. Bernie, I'd like to start out. We have some mutual friends. I was first really introduced to the impact of the mind on the body through Carl Simonton and Norman Cousins. And what's really interesting is to hear the journey of what transformed people. So maybe we could start out with a little background on yourself. What made you want to become a doctor, and what turned you around? I mean, you were a traditional doctor, you know, and traditional education.
I was a traditional doctor, but not a normal one.
Well, that's good.
And I say that because a lot of psychologists send me personality profiles to fill out saying, we don't understand how a surgeon could be doing what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
And so I fill them out, mail them to them, and they all write back saying, we're right, you're not a normal surgeon. Now, what they mean by that has a lot to do with the intuitive, creative, right, you know, feeling aspects that most surgeons don't have. But
Or don't use, at least.
Yeah. But, well, it may not be their personality. And right, I'm not saying that in a critical sense.
Right.
If we choose professions for healthy reasons, that's okay. But a lot of times, unfortunately, we choose them for unhealthy reasons, you know, as reaction formations to our personality characteristics, and then we may become very destructive in those professions. But I entered surgery, and I stopped to think about it because I like people. I liked working with my hands. I've done a lot of painting. I probably would have been an artist if I realized as a child that you could be a creative individual as an artist. I didn't know enough about art. See, I thought it was commercial. In other words, how do you make a living as an artist?
Yeah.
And I didn't know you could be a Van Gogh, you see, or I might do that. So I started painting portraits. So there I was working with my hands. And then I like to fix things. I'm always rearranging and fixing. And that's just part of my personality. I'm making things neater all the time. And I thought, what a neat way of doing it. Become a surgeon. I mean, you can fix, be with people, use your hands. And so there I was doing this. But the part that was painful was, it never occurred to me that you're going to meet people who die, see?
Yeah.
And so that there were things that I was ill-prepared for by medical school. That's what I consider the villain in this whole process, that you're not trained appropriately on how to take care of people. You're trained about disease. And so I went through a period of a lot of suffering, kept a journal which is full of pain. My wife had to remind me that there was a lot of humor because I've always had that part to my personality, but it never appeared in the journal. You know, you forgot what kept you alive and got you through the day. So I ended up feeling the pain, but not sharing it. And I went to workshops, and the first one I went to was Carl Simonton's. And he and Stephanie were together then doing this.
Right.
And at that workshop, one of my patients said to me, she had breast cancer. She was there for her cancer. I was there for what I call my cancer, being a doctor. And she said to me, you know, what I really need to know is how to live between office visits. She was really asking me, how do you live, you see? And if I could give her that. And I really think that's been my search and quest without knowing it. I tell a story now at my workshops that has to do with a boy who takes the king's place. He sacrifices himself with his parents' agreement to it. And just before the boy is about to be killed and his heart literally cut out and handed to a demon, the boy starts to laugh. And it ends with, and all there drop to their knees in an attitude of prayer and stop what they're about. And my question to everybody is, why did the boy laugh? What does he know about life? Hmm. And when you know why that boy laughed, because that story disturbed me when I read it in a magazine, and I started asking lots of people who were close to death, and most of them I didn't feel gave me an answer that hit home. You know, it wasn't I'm going to heaven kind of thing,
right.
But I mean, this boy is laughing. He knows something, what he's accomplished with his life. And I think when we know the answer to that, then we know what life is about. And it isn't not dying.
Yeah.
But obviously of living and what you contribute, and doesn't even limit itself in terms of age. You see, a 7-year-old could do it. 77-year-old might still be struggling to accomplish it. But in that, you see, also came the healing, because the next workshop I went to, and the two that really made the most difference in me, were Simonton's and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Because at Elizabeth's, I met people, see, who were willing to talk to you in a different way, who were struggling with life and these issues. And that's when I started our groups called Exceptional Cancer Patients. And what I found, of course, was, what I laugh, because it was really exciting to help people heal their lives. And then to see a physical change happen. So the people who were supposed to die didn't.
Yeah.
Now, there are articles in the medical literature reporting this now called postponement of death until symbolically meaningful occasions, which on short-term basis mean that if you have a birthday, see, or Christmas or Passover, you don't die till you get there.
Right.
And so you obviously have some role in even how long you live and what you accomplish. And so by giving people goals and giving them a joyful life, I saw them not dying.
Yeah, a compelling future.
Yeah, and so I wrote articles and sent them to the journals because I thought I had discovered something. I mean, it was an incredibly exciting moment, see, how to help people not die, how to help them live. And the articles came back saying, this is interesting but inappropriate for our journal. So I sent it to where it would be appropriate, and then it came back saying, this is appropriate but it isn't interesting. And I realized that the other therapies, so to speak, knew more, you see, than the surgeons and the oncologists and the internists, because they took care of people. And they talked to people. Even nurses and social workers thought I was nuts. They said, well, we know all this stuff. What are you getting so excited about? And
it was just a whole other world.
Yeah, because I was an MD, you see. And I, again, was more into disease. I talked to people a lot more than most doctors did, but it still wasn't to the same extent and with the same content, you see.
You also disconnected emotionally at the time.
And that was happening, which was very painful. And which, you see, I didn't want to let that happen. It's part of why I went to the workshops, because I was brought up by parents who let me know that it wasn't proper to separate from your feelings. I've talked to hundreds of doctors at a time, and you don't get a laugh, and you don't get a tear, and you don't get applause, but you get an evaluation form filled out saying, excellent talk.
Why? Let everybody
because
understand why.
See, that's our solution to all the pain. Don't feel it. But you do feel it, except it's buried, that's all. And so the wall goes up, and that's why I blame medical school. They need to really say, this is going to be a painful, tough job, and are you going to know how to handle this? Are you going to know how to talk about it? Are you going to know how to reach out for help instead of building this wall, and then everybody blames you for being this awful, terrible doctor who has no feelings? And the doctors who feel are really the ones who survive. And there are some wonderful doctors out there, too, that I've met.
Absolutely.
Who really look at their relationship with a patient as a marriage, almost. And that's the part I try to get across now, that these are, you know, it's two people trying to create something that is greater than the two of them. Because Joseph Campbell described marriage as an ordeal. Bobby and I have always described it as a struggle. And so it was really great to come across his article. Because people would look at us as if there's something wrong with us, married almost 37 years and still struggling, you know. and they really look at you kind of cross-eyed if you use that term. But
right.
I said, understand, and here's Campbell's comment. See? He said, anyone who's been married a long time realize that marriage isn't a love affair, it's an ordeal, you see, because love affairs relate to the individual and what you can get out of it, your satisfaction. But the marriage, he said, it's like a sacrament, that two people are creating something that is greater than either, and that it's very exciting to do that. Robert Bly, the poet, used the term a third body, that the two are breathing for a third body. And that's what I see in every relationship, whether it's doctor, patient, husband, wife, client, and, you know, and therapist, that you're creating something more than either of you ever is. And when we see it in that way, some wonderful things happen. And then people thank you for what you've helped them do with their life. Even families, I can show you letter after letter that comes from people who say, my loved one died, but thank you for what you brought into our life while we were alive and what we shared and the love and how you've helped change that and even gave them some control over the living and the dying process.
What did you, let me ask you this, what out of these workshops and out of these new distinctions, what new beliefs did you form and how did they change your actions with your patients?
Well, you might say at one level, at a scientific level, you begin to realize that feelings are chemical and that, well, the most painful thing I began to learn literally is what people's childhoods were like. See, that again, as a surgeon, if you came in with appendicitis, gallbladder, yeah, I might say to you, why are you having an attack now? I began to realize that there were things happening, see, that maybe you were worn out, exhausted, and then you got sick. And you'd say, oh, if you knew what was going on, you'd know why I'm sick. Well, right. I began to ask, why now? Right. Whether it's cancer, AIDS, or, you know, appendicitis, why is this happening now in your life? And that helped people look at why they were vulnerable at that moment and help them go home and straighten their lives out. But then I began to hear stories about childhood, say. I mean, I couldn't be a failure because of my parents. They were always letting me know that God was redirecting me. So if you had an F in a test, you know, you were taking the wrong subject, not you're a failure. You know, maybe that you're not meant to be a musician, say, all right? So those are things I began to learn. And then you hear others who are so abused physically, sexually, psychologically, and there's no question that they're going to be sick adults. And if you've had that kind of painful childhood, until you deal with that, you don't heal yourself. Because let me, to an extreme, that I get a letter from a lady who said, I was born unlovable. That's how the letter begins. Now, you picture a one-day-old baby, say, huh, you know, hell can you say that? Yeah. Well, you can say it if your family never touched you. So she was touched by doctors. She said, for 21 years, how do I get touched? I go to the doctor. So I enjoy being sick. Hmm. You see, and if I can't deal with that issue, how am I ever going to get her to give up her illness? So I know there are lots of people out there who enjoy their illness. Now, if I can substitute love in relationships, they'll be happier. I don't mean they enjoy it in the sense of wanting it, but they know no other way of life. And so they are stuck with this as their way of surviving. There's a line in the Bible that says, he who seeks to save his life will lose it, but he who's willing to lose his life will save it. And I've always said to people that was very difficult for me to figure out. And so one of the helps that I received was a line that said, be what you is and not what you ain't. Because if you is what you ain't what you is. See? And what we all do is, in order to survive, we die, literally. I mean, the true self dies because you need to survive in a certain family, in a certain situation. So you become another person. And then that person really has to die for you to be born. And when you learn you're mortal, that's when a lot of people, what I mean by that is, if you came into my office and learned you have a disease you might die of in 6 months, you go home and say, I'm not going to be that other person that everybody liked, see? Now I have permission to say no, to do what I want tomorrow morning. But one lady said, I wrote on my refrigerator the number of days left in my life. She was told she'd be dead in a year and a half. So she wrote 500 on her refrigerator and said, I'll make every day precious. And 7 or 8 years later, she's alive and well and not dead of AIDS and is writing her own book, you see, on how to make every day precious. But it wasn't to not die. That's what's wonderful about these people. They didn't say, I'm going to do this to not die. They said, I will live until I die. Well, one paragraph, lady said, I was told I was going to be dead in 2 months. And she said, this time I felt so awful, I thought they might be right. Because she'd heard that before from her doctors. But she said, I made out a will. I gave away my valued treasures to family and friends. I started exercising, bought a dog, laughed more, took vitamins, and put in a backyard wildlife habitat my life's desire. Said, if I'm going to die, I might as well do it doing the things I enjoy. And the end of the letter says, I didn't die. Now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? And the point I make...
She needs to rest is all.
Yeah, well, you see, you know that. You know what my answer was? I said, take a nap. You see, and that's why I was going to say, that's exactly where I think your work and mine cross. Because I'm saying to people, don't burn out, burn up. I don't want anything left of your candle when your life is over.
How beautiful.
But when you're burning up, you need a rest or a nap.
Yeah, every now and then.
Yes, right. And then you get up and get going again.
That's right.
But if you're burning out, you're not doing what you love, and so you're exhausted, and the nap doesn't help you either.
Well, it's the lack of meaning that people have in their lives.
Right.
You said something earlier I really want to make sure we catch and come back to, because you said something very important. You said that if throughout our life we have tragedies, we have frustrations, we have horrible events that occur in our lives, that if we don't deal with them and just suppress them, that they store up in our body and there's going to be a price later on. What I want to make sure that we get across to people is I agree with you wholeheartedly, and there are people that have been through those tragedies, but they haven't pulled the same meaning from it. They don't have it stored in their body because they've transformed what that means. Let's talk about that.
I got something worse to notify you about.
Oh, worse.
Yeah, because see, what I do to people is say this. I carry cards with me that are given to me, and I have the permission granted by God to distribute when I give talks. See, you don't have that yet.
How do you know?
I'm on the board of directors in heaven, and you're not at the meetings yet. I brought your name up, though. I want you to know that.
Okay.
But the card says on one side, the bearer of this card is guaranteed a life of 100 years with all the resources necessary. The back says, in order for the guarantee to remain intact, your phone must be working at all times, and if not used properly, you may outlive everyone you love. Now, why? Because think about it. If you live to be 100, see, I know people with cancer who pick up the phone and find out the daughter that they said, get yourself to high school. I'm not driving you anymore. It's your problem. See, they learned that from their group therapy session. And the daughter goes, hitchhikes, and is murdered by a guy who picks her up.
Right.
A mother with cancer says to her son, instead of sitting around in your underwear, your friends wanted to go out to a movie. Why don't you go ahead? And say, Mom, I don't want to. I just go. You'll have a good time. They're killed in an accident. Now, those people say, I want to die of cancer. I don't want to answer the phone anymore. You see. Mm-hmm. So living to be 100 means you're going to pick up the phone and find out you've outlived your spouse, your kids, your loved ones. How do you manage that? Life is full of pain. The great teachers of our time and every generation said, life is filled with sorrow, but let me show you how to find joy in the sorrow.
How do you do that?
It's using the pain, you see. Now, what have some people done? Look at Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Right.
Somebody's child is killed, I'll help others. So start a group. Sit down with parents. That's basically what I do with my pain, is try to help others. I didn't know a thing about living. I laugh at the guts I had to say, okay, folks, I'll teach you how to live, see? And send out letters saying,
we all
I'll teach you how to live.
Yeah, we all teach what you most need to learn. Right?
And, you know, I laugh. I went, read a few books, you know, had all these topics that I was going to, and it was so absurd. I had planned in 12 hours to teach everybody how to live, an hour and a half, eight meetings. And, you know, it's now 13 years later. We're still meeting. See, and I think I got an idea now what it's about. But if you don't know, you see, the ignorance is bliss.
I didn't know,
so I thought this is easy. You know, it's like death, sex, money. I mean, you could have a topic a week, see, and everybody would be all set. And what I realized was that the people who came never paid attention to my topics. I would get the first sentence or two at each meeting, and then nobody paid attention to me. So by the third meeting, I stopped bothering and I just sat and listened to them because they were really dealing with the issues, you know, their life and their threats and all the things that they had heard. And I think this is a part that they began to do, that they used it as a way to find more people to love, you see, that could be joining a group, volunteering. As a matter of fact, one of the things I say now, volunteer 2 hours a week for people you're not related to, and you live a longer, healthier life.
Yeah.
You don't run out of family if you do it in that way.
Yeah.
And so if you live in the moment, life isn't difficult in a sense. And that also gives you permission. I tell this to a lot of people. You've met our son Keith, I think, at one of your workshops.
Yes.
When Keith was 7, I thought he was going to die of a malignant bone tumor. It turned out to be benign. But I had incredible guilt because his leg hurt, and I told him to take a bath. And 3 months later, he said, I need an x-ray. And I thought, what is this kid telling me he needs an x-ray, you know? But we got an x-ray and there was this hole.
Right.
Now, for a week, until he'd had surgery and we learned the diagnosis, the only two things that were most common were two very malignant tumors that he should be dead of in a year. And it was hard for me to understand anything at that moment except that this beautiful kid's going to be dead. And so how can you love? How can you laugh? And you get mad at the other children. We had four other children who wanted to have fun. And I didn't want them to have fun because they had to understand their brother's going to be dead. I mean, this sounds crazy. I understand
but everyone does it.
And Keith said to me, you handled that very poorly. I said, you're right. But I see, that taught me the intensity of knowing what... You see, then I could say to somebody who said, gee, my child has cancer. I say, I know how you feel. And I could really say it, see?
Yeah.
The terms I use now is I was a native. I wasn't a tourist anymore.
Wow.
And when we become natives, we know. But what I learned was that the kids knew about living in the moment. Yeah, brother could be dead, but why can't we go to the movies today? I mean, it didn't make sense. And so I've learned that they were right and I was wrong. You know, that even if you learn you're mortal, you can still laugh today. And so over the years, I spend more time laughing, and I think even in my talks, I'm sure, I get people laughing more and more, and I don't feel guilty about it because I used to finish talks sometimes and say, gee, they were laughing a lot, and this is a serious subject. But nobody ever wrote to me and said, you made me laugh, I'm angry, you know? I didn't come to laugh.
Right.
And so I began to realize it's helping them to survive. And they're realizing that humor is appropriate. And you are alive, so I'm getting you to laugh. And the people who are sick never complain. You know, I'd say maybe you might get a complaint from somebody who came who isn't sick and doesn't understand. You know, like I was in that week. I would have said, why'd you make me laugh? My child is ill.
Yeah.
And I hadn't reached that stage, you know, or they haven't. So they didn't understand that it still is all right. And now I make it very clear to people that why we laugh and what humor is about.
And the healing power of that.
And yes. And then you get back to the science of it, that if you study, when I say feelings are chemical, is my simple way of including all this, that the body is changed by joy. And the chemistry is different, just as by hope. And that, you know, is a lot of what I'm sharing with
people. Give us little specifics about that, if you would.
Well, I was just putting some things together for a little article that two doctors give the same drugs to treat cancer. They begin with the letters E, P, H, and O. But one has 3 out of 4 patients respond, the other has 1 out of 4 patients respond. At a joint meeting, they discovered there was one difference in what they were doing. One called it hope and the other called it EFO. Say, everything else they were doing was identical.
Right.
And you look at things like, why do people have more heart attacks Monday morning, you know, than any other day of the week? That you give people totally inert substances, tell them it's chemotherapy and the hair will fall out, and it does. And on the other hand, if you give them a positive message, they respond to that.
Right.
So you really begin to learn how powerful the body is. This is why I think studying human potential is such an important thing.
Yes.
The line again, I use the Bible a lot of times as a metaphor and there's stories in it, was that your sins are forgiven versus rise and walk. That if you help people heal their lives, it's physiologic. But if you only focus on the rise and walk, the mechanical aspects, then yeah, you might get somebody on their feet, but they still may have a miserable life and end up being sick again or not functioning or making any meaning out of the fact that they can walk.
Oh, that you worked on the effect but not the cause.
Yeah, so that if you teach a quadriplegic to paint with a brush in his mouth, you may really contribute to his life. And rather than wanting to be dead, he's now contributing beauty and love to the world. And that's the part I think that we have so long overlooked. And at the same time, that when you begin to contribute that love and beauty, what does it do to you? And things heal that aren't supposed to.
Right.
So I say, let's study success. You see, you often, I know, do it with people financially, business world, that you study successful organizations or people.
And model them,
I mean,
right.
Yeah. You see, you say it so obvious, but the medical profession
does the other. I know, but
that's
the beauty of what you've done. I mean, you've modeled patients, successful patients, which is like
the opposite.
But
you see, if you said, here's a millionaire, he's called the spontaneous miracle, see?
Right.
And so you can't mimic him, you have to hope you'll have a miracle.
Right.
Then everybody go home and say, oh, that's too bad, I have to wait for a miracle.
Right.
But that's what the medical profession did.
Right.
See, they said, oh, there's a spontaneous remission, there's a miracle, there's a laboratory error. That's exactly what you hear.
Yeah.
So we never study them. And my comment was, if somebody doesn't die, say, why didn't you die? Or why are you a success? And then you hear the same themes, so you can list them and I can list them, that these people are telling us, yes, I learned. I started a journal, I joined a group, I worked on self-love, I did volunteer work, I got a massage, I paid attention to what I ate, I exercised, you know, I bought a dog, whatever it was, but they began to live. And the byproduct was I didn't die.
I think, you know, when we talk about meaning and you talk about the events of people's lives, I've had the privilege of meeting some people who have been through unbelievable tragedies, but have come out on top. I mean, not just on top in terms of results. I mean, emotionally on top, the real on top. And the thing, though, that I find with them is it comes down to what they focus on. That's where the meaning comes from. And what I read in your books were that these patients, when they had dis-ease in their body, their focus went not on how to not die, as you already said, but how to live more. Their focus became on enjoying and contributing and making a difference in their own life. Those are the things that seem to change people. And the same thing seems to be true in people's past history, that it's not the event, but rather what do they focus on the event? Does that event mean that I was no good, or does that event mean that my father had some problems and I, you know, want to help
There's
people like
that
in the future?
There's a lot of lines. One that popped into my head was that an author's best source is an unhappy childhood. So that one man becomes a successful writer because he had a terrible childhood. And another, you see, becomes a derelict and an alcoholic. Well, a friend of mine said, I won't use his name, but he said the blank men, you know, the name of it, like the Smith men, are all dead at 45, you see, due to drinking and drugs. And he decided one day he doesn't have to die at 45 and went to an AA meeting and it changed his life. Viktor Frankl, a psychiatrist coming out of a concentration camp, right, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, said, to live is to suffer, to survive is to find meaning in the suffering. And what I see are the metaphors, you see, that which is really what you're saying. I now ask people, how do you describe your experience and what you're going through? Now, when somebody answers gift, wake-up call, challenge, blessing, new beginning, you don't have a problem. And they're talking about cancer and AIDS,
right,
okay?
Right.
But when somebody says monster, eating me up alive, painful, invisible, loss, then I begin to say to them, all right, how do those words fit your life, see?
Also, if you try to treat them before changing that belief...
That's right. If you treat the disease, if you treat breast cancer, you're not taking care of the people. Because 100 people with breast cancer or colon cancer or AIDS or multiple sclerosis or lupus, whatever, give you 100 metaphors.
Right.
So if you treat them, but you see, it's also getting them on their path. One of the men wrote to me and said, path reports are not pathology reports. They're reports on whether you're on your path in life. So the metaphor, see, if you said to me, I see my disease as a failure. One lady said that. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, my body has failed me. I said, but how does failure fit your life? I mean, how else would that word fit? And she said, my parents committed suicide when I was a kid, so I must have been a failure as a child.
Hmm.
See, now I can help her deal with failure. And that,
right,
lady's a very different lady today,
right,
because of that. And let me just say this.
Yeah.
You see, that takes courage. You and I do not have the right to walk up to somebody who is having a problem, say, whose child has died, who is,
right,
sick, and say, well, you got a gift here. It has to be found
well,
by that
mean
person.
Anything. Yeah, I was going to say, if you tell them that, yeah, they're going to, it has no meaning. But what you and I can do is ask questions that guide people to the point where they realize it's a gift,
right,
and where they tell us.
Or get them in touch with other people who have done it. That's
exactly
why I use the term,
yes,
native and tourist. You,
yes,
see, that if you get in touch with somebody who, see, if you put everybody who's quadriplegic in a room full of quadriplegics, nobody can say, bull, you can walk home.
Right.
Okay, so they can give it to each other and love each other and discipline, and then they come out of it. But if you and I are in that room telling them how to behave,
oh, sure,
they can say, what do you know? You're going to walk home and leave us here in our,
that's,
wheelchair.
Right. Which is the value of the pain that we've had in our lives. Right. It allows us to relate with people, as you said. Let me cut back for a moment to just what the possibility is within the human body, because you've had so many incredible references there. I'd like people to get a sense of it. I think one of the biggest challenges a lot of people live with, consciously or unconsciously, is this fear that something's going to attack them and strike them down. And I know, for example, my own life, till the time I was about 20 years old, my big fear was, yeah, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to have an impact and I'm going to help people and I'm going to feel like my life is worthwhile and I'm going to succeed. But boy, this thing, cancer, what if something like that struck me down? And so that caused me to really study health. That's like, mm-hmm, involved with, you know, Simonton and Norman Cousins and people like that. And filling my mind with the understanding that, hey, things don't strike you down. That the microbe is nothing, as we found out. It's the terrain is everything.
Right.
You know, as Pasteur himself finally,
right,
admitted. And I noted,
right,
you have that in your book as well. So I think it would be really wonderful if maybe you could share with people my belief and the belief of many natural hygienists is that disease is due to a deficiency of force. Your body can fight off things, but you know, when you're denervated or enervated, things are lowered and your body's not going to respond the same way. And that comes from emotional situations. I remember reading the study, I think you listed, where 68 out of, I think it was 71 cancer patients had found that they had prolonged sorrow before, you know, they'd ever,
right,
come down with the disease. So maybe you can talk about that.
I think that what we have to look at, so again, we don't create guilt here, is that there are genetic factors and there are poisons.
No doubt
but,
about it.
See, if you look at genetic factors, I know several sets of identical twins where one has had cancer and the other never has.
Right.
And you'd say, well, how come they have the same genes? Or we talked about this earlier, off, you know, tape, so to speak. If you look at things like psychosocial factors and poisons, mm-hmm, that lovers are more resistant to poison. Now, that may sound crazy, but relationships help you. And one article came out. It's a known fact that women live longer than men with the same cancer.
Yes.
And so an article came out from Sweden, and it started out by saying, do estrogen and progesterone protect from metastatic cancer? And then it gave this long table of all the cancers that men and women have in common, how women do better. But if you know also, as I do, that married men live longer than single men with the same cancer, then your next study would be, does sleeping with estrogen and progesterone protect from metastatic cancer? You see, and I think that's where you can carry this to a scientific extreme,
yes,
or say, wait a minute, couldn't relationships be scientific?
Yes.
So that the key, I think, to all of what you're saying is mental health, really.
Yes.
That we haven't really accepted this fact, that wellness is cost-effective also, that if you give people, and this was one study done in Hawaii, short-term mental health, 45,000 federal employees in a specific health program were given mental health care. Now, those who received it, they spent one-third less money on those individuals for physical illnesses than the control group. And the same is true with survival, that if you put people in group therapy with cancer, AIDS, or any other disease, they live longer. Some of them get better when they're not supposed to. So you can't separate yourself from your life.
Yeah.
And to me, it's simply, as I said earlier, living up to your potential. Supposing everybody in your family died of a heart attack when they're 40 or was dead of cancer by the time they're 40 and you make it to 60. You've done a lot. But how have you done it? By looking at self-destructive behavior, enjoying your life, you know, not hating your job and what you're doing every day or drinking yourself to death or whatever it is. Yeah, I've watched people die within a week of their father's death and say they were going to. But yeah, they worked hard at killing themselves.
Yeah.
And I think those are things that we have to look at. And if we look at the mental health side, then I think we will live our longest, healthiest lives. The Adaptations to Life, a book written by George Valent, studied Harvard graduates. I mean, they just followed them. And what they found basically was those who were mentally well-adjusted, and that was their term, had one-tenth the serious illness and death rate in the decades after graduation than those who were mentally unhealthy.
Yeah.
And they're still following them.
Yeah.
There were people like Kennedy in that study who can get assassinated, and you say may be the president and mentally healthy, but, you know, those happen too.
Right.
But they were excluding factors like smoking and drinking. I mean, they were really focusing down on mental health as the one element.
Right.
And when I say excluding, I don't mean they eliminated them. I mean, statistically, we're balancing these things out and see what a power that mental health is. Because, again, it gets back to the physiology that you are different when you have peace of mind.
Yeah.
That you are different when you're laughing joyfully.
Yes.
You're different when you're meditating, and your chemistry is different. And the truth also is that it's not just a state of mind, but it's a state of body mind.
Yes.
That there are receptor sites in your body so that your blood vessels, your kidneys, your liver, your bone marrow know when you're happy. And that may sound crazy, but believe me, they're getting a message. And interestingly, we're also seeing this as a feedback mechanism that even your immune system secretes hormones so that it's a constant interplay between mind and body that says, how do I feel?
Mm-hmm.
How am I working? Depression and despair say I don't like living, so don't make more white blood cells. You know, don't stop coronary artery disease.
Yes.
And the potential is, our friend Dean Ornish, you may be familiar with his work in California, cardiologist, has shown reversal of coronary artery obstruction by the same kinds of therapies we're talking about.
Yes.
You do an angiogram, there's more blood flowing to the heart due to group therapy, low-fat diet, meditation. Yeah, and this is a part of what I think is exciting, of what we are capable of creating. And I would even go beyond that, what I call studies of consciousness that I think will come up in the next decade. If I pray for you, does it help you? If I think about a machine, does it affect the machine?
Mm-hmm.
And some studies have shown that this is true.
Yes.
And I'm talking about basic scientists in Princeton and, you know, physicians and others who have done these studies. It's hard to get studies done when somebody doesn't believe in something.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know what this all comes back to always is belief. I mean, the one thing that every religion on earth talks about, because whatever you believe with absolute certainty, your body responds to with absolute...
Well,
you know, the chemicals are secreted based upon your perception of reality.
Yeah, so the problem is knowledge.
Yes.
See, what you know creates a problem. Because then when somebody comes in and says, maybe this isn't so, you say, oh no, I know that. I learned in college.
Yeah.
I learned in medical school. And so in the beginning, I went out trying to change people's belief systems. They yelled at me.
Yes.
And I thought, what am I doing here? I'm going to come to be yelled at. You know, I mean, what's the point of creating conflict? But I was trying to be scientific, say.
Yes.
And tell them things that would change their minds.
Yes.
And they got mad. And so I started telling stories. And people don't get mad at you for stories.
Yeah.
See, they say, well, that's anecdotal. It's non-statistical. I don't have to get confronted. But since every scientist, physician has, you know, anecdotes, they come back with more anecdotes. And so before you know it, you're having a nice time sharing stories, and then they are changed by the stories. It really becomes hypnotic in a sense.
Well, it makes them begin to ask new questions.
That's right. So when they go back to the office, they say, oh, you're what he was talking about.
And they're not so certain anymore that they can't be turned around.
Yeah.
That's part of the beauty of your work is you're offering people, I think, through those stories, new references to create new beliefs from.
Yeah.
And
to see them differently. See, rather than one lady with AIDS, because I work with a lot of prisoners and sending them material and things,
yes.
said that she had her blood test, which was HIV positive, redone, and it was HIV negative. And the doctor called her in and said, either you had a laboratory error or a miracle.
Right.
Now, my hope is, you see, that third option, maybe you did something, that it wasn't a lab error and it isn't just a miracle. What have you been doing the last year
yeah.
that might have converted your blood test?
Yeah.
And that the doctor will ultimately not be afraid to ask that question. See, did you do something?
Yeah.
The guilt, fault, and blame, as I say, underlies all of this all the time, you see, because if you don't get well and you don't convert your blood test, then maybe you didn't do it right or do something wrong.
So a lot of people don't begin because they don't want to have
that
happen.
And I think that's the struggle in the medical profession and in people's lives that we really must get around someday by bringing up kids to be loved so they don't feel this way.
Yeah.
See, people read my books, and one writes to me and says, thanks for inspiring me.
Yeah,
and the other
life.
One writes and says, I'm angry at you. You made me feel guilty. And I say, hey, wait a minute. How could this be? It's the same words.
Yeah.
Why are you feeling good and you're feeling bad? Could it be what's happening in your life? And then they get madder and say, oh, now you're blaming me for, you know, feeling guilty and I'm not, and it goes on and on.
Yeah.
But I say, no, I'm not. I'm asking you, where does this start in your life? These kinds of feelings.
Yeah.
What were your parents like? How did you feel in school? There's one other little story I meant to share that I ask people to do lots of drawings, you know, draw yourself, your disease, your treatment, so that you get a concept of and their immune system of what's going on. And one lady came back and said, here, and I looked at the drawing and it said at the bottom, my 10-year-old son did this because I'm not good at drawing.
Hmm.
Now, you see, you're trying to fight cancer and you're afraid to get an F in art. I mean, does it make sense? You know, this is the part I bring up. See,
great.
I didn't make her feel guilty
right.
or like a failure.
Right.
But she could say to me, well, you're asking us to draw pictures. You, and this is the sadness of it. What people who feel like failures are seeing in what I've written are things that I haven't written.
Yes.
And they quote me. And I've had this happen several times. People quote me in anger. And I say, well, open the book. Find the quote. And they can't find it.
I've had the same experience.
But then I say to them, you saw it. That I won't argue with you about. You
yes.
saw that, but you created the words.
Yes.
And that's why the drawings are powerful, you see, because when they create symbols, let's say somebody draws himself without heads, arms, and legs. You say, well, here's a helpless person, see? And you're going to have kids that feel like that too. And they say, oh, yeah, you said draw yourself, and I left my head off, and I have no arms, or, you know, or I'm reaching for my husband. He's never there when I need him. I mean, those symbols come up. And then they understand, and it's not me telling them. And the
yes.
inspired people, I say, look, you're giving me credit for things I didn't write either, because that's what you're like.
That's
so,
true.
You know,
that's
you
true.
Just pick it up and you take off from there.
Once again, it comes back to what do they focus on. The thing that I would ask of you, I would give you a challenge, is when you ask the person, well, what is it in your life that made that happen? That almost gives credibility to that. I might ask a different question. I might ask them, what belief have you developed out of those experiences of your life? Because if they, a belief is something you can change.
Yeah.
I can't change my childhood, but I can sure as heck change the beliefs that I have.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately what I asked them
that probably
to do.
Bring them to do.
Also, the way I ask the question is to say, what happened last year or two in your life?
Oh, that's
so
great.
I don't put blame on it,
yes.
but what happens is they begin to get in touch
that's
with,
smart.
My son was killed, I was, you
yeah.
know, divorced, or... And
yeah.
then you see, you get into how did that affect you
right.
and what does it mean?
That's right.
But I think
sense.
You're right in the sense of beliefs. And that's why, as I was telling you earlier, I often, if people come to any workshop or talk I give and I see a baby in the audience, I ask them to give me the baby.
Yeah.
Sometimes my sense of humor enters into it too. I often say, let me have the baby. We're going to do two things. One is we're going to vote on whether it's lovable or not. And then if you have a ticket under your seat, you win the baby in the raffle. You know, take it home. But
I'll have to use that one.
One lady said, because I walk up to a lot of people, a lot of crazy things. I said, would you sell me your baby? She said, call me back at 2 a.m. The price is lower. most people run when they see you. And,
oh, that's great.
But when you hold that baby up, you know, everybody automatically goes, ooh, and applauds.
Yeah.
If you have people massage each other, which I often do in the middle of a talk.
Oh, I do too all the time.
They start applauding. I don't know
yeah.
if you notice
yeah.
that. And I say,
sure.
why are you applauding? All you did was touch. But you see, they are changed by seeing the baby. They're changed by touching each other. But then I get back to the fact that if you touch this baby, it will gain weight faster, which is scientifically true. And if you don't touch babies, they're more likely to commit suicide as adolescents, you see, which is a crazy statistic, but if you look up the birth records of adolescent suicides, you will find that they may have been on respirators or, you know, in terrible homes, or that, again, it's statistical that yes. those things have happened. And so it shows people, again, how your childhood, how touch, how all these things enter into it, but to try to connect again with the beliefs. You see, that if you were born lovable, then how can we be having all this trouble? Yeah. And that it becomes the beliefs that you're imbued with, see?
Yes.
And what you then need to do to survive. And I think that's the right. important part, that don't blame yourself for working on this other belief system that may not be healthy, because it was a way of you being alive rather
Absolutely.
Than dead. If you had fought everything, you might not be here today.
Well, and a lot of the painful experiences of your life will give you the grounding for new beliefs and new yeah. appreciations. My personal belief is that you are who you are because of certain core beliefs. That's the difference between you and other surgeons.
Right.
I am who I am because of certain beliefs. And a lot of beliefs we have now are quite different than beliefs we once held. But what we had is the courage to look at those beliefs and say, does this really make sense? Instead of defending it and saying, this is absolutely it, one day we said, hey, this isn't working. So maybe I ought to take a look at my life. I think it's the difference between having a conviction where you have so much emotion behind the belief you're not willing to look at it, and having an opinion that you're willing to have some new input into.
That's where one of the characteristics I found of the exceptional human being, and we're all capable of that. I'm not trying to make a subgroup of non-exceptional, because that's another problem you get into.
Yeah.
Right. It's just living up to your potential, was that they're not afraid to make choices and really take charge of their life, and that you are doing what's right for you. See, there's a big difference between vegetarianism because it makes every day precious, and vegetarianism because it'll prevent dying.
Yeah.
See, when you get online up in heaven, one is happy with what they did, and the other one's furious because they died anyway, and look at the things they didn't eat. And that's the part that I try to get across to people. Don't do things to not die. It really gets to be a burden.
Yeah.
My mother was told that not to have any children. See, I mean, I learned a lot about myself by going back in my history, really, sitting down with my parents. But my mother had hyperthyroidism and was told she could die if she became pregnant. They didn't know what would happen. But she wanted a child. And she became pregnant. And the funny thing, one of the funny lines was, the doctor said, I'll try to get you through this if you just gain some weight. So she lay down on the sofa, basically, and had her mother keep feeding her until she gained some weight and was able to carry through. But then I was born, and her hyperthyroidism disappeared. So you understand how it's hard for me to ever let down my mother, if you know what I mean. It's like she's got a kid, she's well, what a gift, you see. So
yes.
I probably could have been a mass murderer, and my mother would still, you know, send me files to prison in chocolate cake, you know, saying, you're such a wonderful kid, they don't understand you. But that's the kind of feeling, you know, you grow up with. So that I got to a point where I was rather shocked with myself sometimes, that you'd biopsy somebody, tell them they have cancer in the recovery room, and be able to give them a little talk, sermon kind of thing, so that in 15 or 20 minutes, we were talking about disease as a gift and how it could help alter their life and heal their life.
And where they believed.
And they were not mad, yeah. And they would come in a week later, have stitches removed, or talk, and they'd say, you know, you're right. I have seen how I have changed, and how some things just aren't important anymore, and that there is a gift within this problem and this disease. And so they were already, you might say, off on the right foot, you see, in terms of how to approach it. And that statistics don't apply to individuals. So that
that's a really important point.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people who had a 1% chance of being alive who are alive, say.
Right.
But they could be dead if the wrong things were said to them, if hope were taken away. And some of the examples, I said I was writing this little article, somebody hears that he has a Gallop rhythm, which means a severe form of heart disease. And the man recovers, and when the nurse asked why, he said, you heard the doctor, my heart is as strong as a horse. Somebody died when they heard a doctor say TS, which is a heart murmur that is not terribly significant functionally, called tricuspid stenosis. The lady died that day. She heard the word on rounds, those letters, and when the nurses were caring, you know, and the residents were in there because she went into shock and her pulse became irregular, she said, you heard the doctor. He said, I'm a terminal situation. So what we say to people can kill them or keep them alive. And
unfortunately, there's no training in traditional medical school
on
how to do that.
And that's the sad part. And so we look at the statistics and we put the burden on the person, say, you'll be dead in. You don't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you see, what I say is bet on it to people. I mean that. That if you were told you'd be dead in 6 months, I say, go back with $10,000, put it on the doctor's desk and say, if I'm not dead, you give me 10. If I am dead, you keep this. And no doctor bets.
That's right. We've done that.
You see, they say, well, I can't be sure. Then why are you telling me I'll be dead? See, if you can't be sure. And so that little line has saved a lot of people with AIDS, particularly, because they all laugh and say, you know, you're right. They can't really know. I said, that's true. So do you want to give it a shot? And then they start fighting. And this brings me back again. Carl Menninger, who became a friend and died when he was 97, a beautiful man, has written all the things we're talking about 40 and 50 years ago.
Right.
And he wrote many books, Man Against Himself, Love Against Hate, The Vital Balance, which are dealing with these same issues, but more obvious to psychiatrists and psychotherapists, and also in his training. Because one of the things that struck me in his book was that if you're going to be a psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, you have to look at your problem so that you don't hurt people. The difficulty is that if you're going to be a surgeon, say, or an internist or an oncologist, nobody says your words are powerful.
Yeah.
Yes, you can make a mistake in the operating room if you cut the wrong thing or you wrote the wrong prescription, but how about the wrong words? One other thing I wanted to bring up that Helen Keller taught me a lot. First of all, going blind and deaf at the age of 19 months, you see, because we meet people who say, how do you know God doesn't want me to have cancer? See, how do you know? Or how do you know God doesn't want me to be poor? See, I read one wonderful little Hasidic tale that said why atheists were put on this planet. Because you pass a poor man in the street, you see, who's begging. And one man says, well, God wants him to be poor. And the other one says, I'm an atheist, so I'll give him a dollar. And that's the part, you see, that I meet people say, how do you know God doesn't want me to have cancer? I have to deal with that issue. And I have answers for that.
Well, what are your
answers? In terms of resource. Well,
oh, in terms of resources?
No. I mean, in terms of my own resources to answer that, because most physicians wouldn't know what to say. But I think, again, Maimonides said that disease is a loss of health. And the Bible tells us that we need to help our neighbors find whatever they've lost, so to restore it. And I also tell the same tale where a man who ran a vineyard asked his rabbi, how do you know God doesn't want me to have cancer? And the rabbi says, what do you do for a living? He says, I run a vineyard. He says, what do you mean you run a vineyard? He says, well, I prune, clip, pick, fertilize, you know, we do all the things so we'll have good grapes and wine. And he said, oh, I thought grape growing was up to God. And that we begin to realize that obviously we have to participate and that God is a resource and not a punisher. But it's a real issue for people that, again, nobody taught me in medical school that there are people I'll be taking care of who want to die and feel it's appropriate to die or are avoiding treatment for their kid because they feel it's punishment that they deserve. And if I don't ask those questions, you see, I can't help those people. See, this is why I want to get back to Helen Keller. I mean, she said, my disease is not punishment, that God may discipline us but doesn't chastise us. And that, again, she saw in her disease an opportunity. I mean, it's incredible to read. But she said something very important. I want to ask you a test question.
Great.
If you had an opportunity to be deaf or blind, which would you choose?
That's a good question.
Yes, I know.
As much as I love sight, I don't know. I guess you could communicate through visual as well. I'd have a tough time with that one. My initial one, I would say, would be deaf because you could still communicate by sign language and still be able to see. I think that's what I think I would take the deaf.
The majority of people choose deafness, okay? Yeah. And I think that has more to do with fear of the darkness.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really do. And that, again, is a wonderful metaphor that when we go into our darkness, well, if you compress charcoal, you end up with diamonds. So if you're not afraid to go into the dark, you'll come out with a lot of gifts.
Oh, very nice.
But what Helen Keller said was the end of this paragraph. She said, deafness is darker by far than blindness. Because what she realizes is that in the listening is the power. When we listen to each other, that's how we really communicate with each other. And it is through the voice and the ability to listen. When I say that, I mean that if I've got a problem and I talk to you, you don't have to say a word, but just what you're doing now, nod your head, look at me with compassion, I will feel better. I get 20-page letters from people. At the end of the letter, it says, I don't care if you read this or not, I feel better. You know, they have put their lives together in order to explain it to me, so the solution is on page 20. They don't need me anymore, but they mail it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's what I began to realize, why the groups also become powerful.
Mm-hmm. This session continues on the next CD.
When we share our pain and our problems, we heal ourselves. And the people who share with us feel better.
Yeah.
See, not to cure you. That's where I think we get confused. That if your family and your group thinks, oh, I can't cure the problem, don't tell us, it just upsets us. No, you can't cure it. That's right. Care. Hold hands. Listen. Share. Hug. You are doing something for that person.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably another wonderful message came from a lady named Anita who said that, when you have your health, you don't have everything. But when you don't have your health, if you have somebody who cares for you and loves you, that's when you have everything. It is, again, as you were saying before, how you deal with that event rather than the event that becomes so significant, and why we then get back to parents and religions and teachers, all the authorities in our life who teach us ways of looking at the world.
Yes.
So if we've been fortunate enough to have been loved by our parents, well, example of that, I sent out circulars, and maybe you want to try it in some of your publications, to start a group called Adult Children of Functional Families.
What a
concept. We sent out 100,000 flyers trying to get an organization started, and three people came to the first annual meeting. And I think that's the problem that we're really struggling with, that we have so many dysfunctional human beings. And again, it isn't blaming anybody. It's like Adam and Eve are the problem, you know? If they'd done it right, we'd all be better. But it is dealing with this dysfunctional background that makes it hard for us to function.
Yeah.
It takes real effort to give up the dysfunctional or addictive behavior. It's easier to be the victim. It's easier to blame the substance or blame life or, you know, the food or whatever it is.
Right.
But when you say, I am responsible and I participate, that's where a lot of people got mad at me. They said, you have responsibility, you participate in your life. Even the word patient means a submissive sufferer. So we tend to...
Does it really?
Yeah,
is that the Latin?
That's the root meaning of it. Well, and why I say to people, get the word uncooperative in your medical record, you'll live a lot longer. because it says I'm a person, you know, and I want to be treated that way.
Yeah.
And I think when you're willing to take on that responsibility and participate and make choices and ask questions, you're seen as a difficult patient, but it's also survival behavior. I'm not asking you to create conflict or an adversarial relationship or threaten the lives of everybody, but to say I'm a person and I have a right to speak up. I'm not bed two, because that one lady said, they come in and say, how's bed two doing? You know, and then they talk and they don't even listen to me. And she says, when they went out the door, she said, I yelled after them, how is bed two doing? So they recognize a person in bed two.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we all need to become, that person.
And understanding that is that this person is the healing force, that if they're working with the healing force.
See, if you know
themselves.
Everybody's life story, and that's the way I put it. When I look at an audience, I know everybody's life story in the audience. And if they look at me puzzled, I say, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll call out 15 problems, stand up when I mention yours. And then everybody gets quiet and they don't question you anymore, see? they've happened in our family too. And I'm talking about in-laws, you know, self, wife, and children.
Sure.
I mean, in that immediate group. So we belong in a lot of groups too. But I have learned from those groups. And when we've been in group therapy, they missed me because, as one of our kids said, it's not so much action when you're not there, you know? Because if I'm going to be there, I want to confront something. I'm not just there saying, well, it's fine. I mean, let's deal with the issues. And yet to learn from that pain and then be more help to others. And so when you know others' life story, it's easier to love them. Martin Luther King Jr. said, it's a good thing Jesus told us to love everyone, not like everyone, because there are some people you can't like.
Hmm.
Now, that's something we have to understand. One other question I would ask you and then clarify it. If you had 6 months to live and the phone rang, and you've heard me say, make every day precious, and a friend said to you, want you to help me today. And what you hear is what you don't want to do. I mean, it isn't something you really want to do when your friend is done. And then your friend says, well, when can I expect you? Would you say to your friend, I'm not coming over, or I'll be over when I'm done with breakfast?
I think I would ask them how important it was to them.
No.
That would matter most to me.
Yeah, it's important to them, but you don't want to do it.
I'd tell them I don't want to do it, but I'd tell them, I'd also try to find out how important is it really to them. That's my
In other words, you don't want to answer the question.
No, that's a good honest.
The answer is yes or no, okay? Because what I said was, it may be important to your friend, but you don't want to do it.
I think that in life, sometimes it's important to do what you don't want to do in the short term if it's contributing something important enough in the long term. If you want to become helping move,
yeah, but see, then you're changing the question.
Well, that's the key to life.
No. The answer really is that, let me tell you, in another a lady that was like you in our workshop, she said, well, it's that sort of a gray thing, she said. I said, all right, you have a day to live. The phone rings.
A day to live, the answer is no.
You, well, she said, well, probably not. See,
no, I'd say
and
no.
Everybody roared, you know. Yeah. But you see, the answer is, if you want to be a long-term survivor, the answer is no.
Yeah, clearly.
See? Because we keep saying, you don't want to do it. And people keep fudging the question. Yeah. If you switch to, I do want to do it, fine. The answer is yes. Go. Because, see, then you're giving something to the world. And it doesn't matter how hard it is. As we said, you're burning up. This is my energy, what I want to do, and I'll come home, I'm going to take my nap, and I'll be okay again. Yeah. But always, I think we have to understand, if you don't want to do something, the answer is no. If you want to do it, fine.
But let me ask you a question. See, I have a different belief system about that. My belief is that you can choose to really want to do something. I may not want to do it in this moment, but if I find some other meaning in it, I may really love
it. But then it changes the context.
But that's what to me what life is about. My life is about not just not doing what you don't want to do, but finding the things you don't want to do and finding something that gives it meaning and richness.
Yes. That, you see, if that friend calls you and you said, I had other plans, but this is what I will choose to do today, see my way of loving the world, then you have arranged your schedule, but you're off
to me,
doing.
To because it could become an expression of love.
Yeah, because that's right. Otherwise, what happens? You give your friend a few hours, okay?
Well,
then
if you stay
the next
resentful,
week you need something,
and
you call them up, and they only give you 1 hour. So it's obvious you're nicer than, and it goes on and on. And but yet again, we're brought up to say yes. And what I tell people is, it's a wonderful way to manipulate your neighborhood. Call all your neighbors up, give them all the things you need done. Mow my lawn, shop for me, and everybody does it. And then they start calling you, and you say no.
Right.
And when they say, what do you mean no? Say, I'm teaching you how to be healthy. If you didn't want to help me, you should have said no.
You're going to teach classes on rapport next, right, Bernie?
but I think that's an important lesson because most of us are, well, one lady in my office with breast cancer said, someday my day will come. But you see, if you wait, and that's why all these people sort of pop up into my head when I tell these stories. A lady whose husband died, he had a heart attack. It was a tragic event, sudden death. She met another gentleman. And they decided to get married. But she said, and she was in our groups because of breast cancer, that it'll look funny to the neighbors, so we better wait a year. You know, otherwise it might look like we were having an affair, you know. So they waited a year, and they got married, and he was killed in an accident 2 weeks later. And, you know, she came in and said, we wasted a year of our lives for the neighbors. And that's the part I'm trying to get across to people. Don't waste a day of your life or a year of your life for the neighbors, because you don't gain love by it. The other is, literally, three people I know who have been held up at gunpoint who said to the person holding them up, I love you. One was a minister who said, I know behind that mask is someone you can love. The other is a gentleman who said he was eating his lunch in a car, in his car in a parking lot, and somebody jumped in the car, put a gun on him, and said, give me your money. And he said, I wish I had more money, and I love you. And the man gave him his money back. The minister got her purse back, and I forgot what the third one was, but basically the same story, and they all left. 10 years later, the minister was also rewarded because this man showed up in her church, came up to her and said, you do not have any idea who I am, but I held you up 10 years ago, and you changed my life.
Wow.
And the point I make is that you might die at that moment, but I would rather die having said the last three words of my life, I love you, than I hate you, or why are you doing this to me? Because they're doing it because of their parents. Now, that doesn't mean I like, you know, I don't like what Hitler did, okay? I don't like what Hussein is doing. But they are a product of their childhood. So, I mean, well, what could allow them to behave like that, you see?
Those references are definitely the part of their childhood. And the question that I always ask, my counter question to you now, what about people like Hussein, who was raised by an abusive father? I know his story. What about people that have grown up out of that same environment and made a decision instead that
to
what
not
that meant?
Be like that.
Yeah, a decision to go out and contribute. See, I don't believe it was his parents. I believe that I didn't have that same abusive childhood, so who am I to judge? But I can see so many people that have overcome that by making different choices.
Yeah.
And I think it's important we remind ourselves
that. I would guess that what saved the others was somebody in their life who said, you're lovable. You're beautiful. See, this is part of why when people don't accept what I'm saying to them, I don't want your surgery, I don't want your groups, I don't want anything. I say, that's okay, I love you anyway.
Yeah.
Let me see you next week.
Yeah.
Through that love, I've changed a lot of people who were totally self-destructive.
Yes.
Because I stuck it out through their smells and their addictions and their horrors and their hugs. I mean, literally, they hugged you, you need to change your clothes. And, you know, through their abuse of me and testing me.
Yeah.
And I still said, I love you. And one day they come in, bathe, have a job. I mean, it's incredible what happens. And you never told them to do any of those things, but they found it because somebody reparented them. Yeah. Now, I think that what, the, you know, that abusive parenting lets you see is that this is a type of behavior that you learn.
Yeah.
But if someone or something comes along and says, hey, you have a choice, then they may make that other choice. And it could be a loving school teacher. It could be your grandparent.
That would be my point. I think a lot of the problems
are
just
parents. May be that they develop cancer. See, maybe if Hussein had cancer 15 years ago, he would have said, hey, what is life about? Maybe I have another choice and another way of living, and would have chosen something different.
Yeah.
See? Or he might have gotten madder at the world, saying, look what God did to me. Gave me those parents and cancer, because I see those people too. And they are so mad and rage. And literally, I've had calls from nurses saying that there's a man up here who's threatening to kill us. And, well, their sentence is, could you come up and help us? You'll probably like him.
Yeah.
Now, I go up and like him because of his aggressiveness, but I teach him there's no point in killing nurses. Why don't you fight your disease, you see? Why don't you change your life? And a lot of those people have become incredibly spiritual, loving individuals. One lady's quote, a friend of mine, Susan, said, I let love into my prison. She said, I didn't choose my parents. And a lot of other things. And everybody in her family committed suicide, and they were mad at her for not doing it.
Huh.
So you grew up with, her quote was, I grew up with a simple message, die, kid, die. I have no photographs of my childhood because my parents never took one. See, I said that to her. I said, bring me a picture of you as a baby. We'll look at it together, and you'll see you're lovable. I said, I don't have any. Hmm. So, yeah, she isn't a murderer.
Yeah.
She said, I let love into my prison. And she's an incredible lady, but I think she made it because I listened to her. I mean, I listened to her rage, and I mean, it was scary to sit in a room with her. Yeah. It was for me, because I wasn't a therapist. And when I started listening to her life, I mean, I just sat with my mouth open, which I keep saying was the best form of therapy for her, because I had no answers and no suggestions. I just listened in awe. And I listened for enough months that she finally said, all the garbage is out, and now there's room to let some love in.
That's neat. Maybe the message for people in life is utilize whatever gifts, whatever those gifts are, whatever life gives you, you got to find a way to utilize
it. The sentence I see from a lot of people who are physically handicapped is, I'm not disabled, I'm enabled.
Hmm.
And so I have friends who ski blind in the handicapped Olympics, you know, without limbs. They're incredible people who are taking on a new challenge. And then you meet others who are screaming in a rage at what God did to them. I have letters from people with epilepsy saying, how dare you ask me why I may want this illness or how I may benefit from it. And then I have letters from a young woman with athetoid cerebral palsy. She has no control over any part of her body. To type me a letter, she has to be tied and gagged in a chair, so that she doesn't drool and bang into the machine. And with her nose, she types letters to me. Hmm. Now, if you saw the movie My Left Foot, I don't know if you have.
No, I
but
did not.
I'd say get a chance to see, again, how somebody uses, you see, this dysfunction to write books and create beauty. And she does, too. And she also, something that's very powerful to me, two things. One, in her last Christmas card, she said, let's spend Christmas with somebody less fortunate than we are. Well, if you met her, you would say, it's hard to find somebody less fortunate. But she says, I'm okay, see, and I don't want anybody else's troubles. I don't want people to say, I am helping them live because of my misfortune. She gets mad if you say that. And she's teaching people to look at their troubles. Because one of the things that I've often said at workshops is, if you don't like your problem and what you came with, go to the back of the room, there's a pad and a pencil, put your name and address and problem down, and I'll switch your problem with somebody else who signs up. Nobody ever signs up. See, I say, but there must be somebody with the worst problem in the world, so you'll go to the back and sign up, because you can't lose. But we all begin to realize that we get comfortable, in a sense, with our troubles, and in many ways they become our gifts. I mean, I get letters also saying my disease and pain went away, and I was scared to death. I was more afraid when it disappeared. Yeah. And when it came back, it was like an old friend.
Yeah, exactly.
And now I'm getting ready to get well, see, to really heal my life, so I'll be prepared for that time.
Well, you know, we mentioned earlier about dysfunctional families. You know, my personal belief is I hate that term because everybody's from a dysfunctional family.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And
right.
I think the reality is, and in spite of quote-unquote dysfunctional families, a lot of people's lives turn out well. I think the reality is maybe that's what a functional family's like.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a functional family isn't our idea of what we saw in Father Knows Best, but a functional family is a group of people who all have different lessons to learn, who are going through different kinds of challenges, and out of that, they're teaching each other if they're willing to listen to each other.
That's part of what I try to do with our children, that two things I've seen evolve. One is a few years ago, and one of them was mad at me for being a doctor. You know what I mean? You're not here, you're out there, you're doing things. They forget, see, that I was a Cub Scout master and a this and a that.
Yeah.
He spent a lot of time. But if he has that view, then he doesn't remember that. So I said, all right, from now on, you will assume that I'm an alcoholic and I'm no use to you, that I'm always asleep, drunk on the sofa. Now, what are you going to do with your life? You're going to keep complaining about me, or you're going to straighten your life out, you see? And that stops him because, you know, is his life my fault or is it his life? And so you've got a dysfunctional father. Now, what do you choose to do?
Yeah.
The other was that years ago, I learned from the groups that little sentence, that's your problem. Because I would come home, you know, five kids would be waiting at dinner and they'd tell me all their troubles. And I would manipulate a lot of things. I thought I was doing them a favor because as a doctor, I knew everybody in town. So, you know, from the gym teacher on down, if something went wrong, I would talk and make their lives easier. And I realized I wasn't making their lives easy. I was making it worse. So I started coming home saying, that's your problem. Boy, they were mad. And it takes 3 to 6 months if you start doing that with your family, because I got a kick out of watching them come towards me, and then you could see the brain working, saying, I'll tell him my problem, but he'll say it's your problem, so there's no point in saying it. So they would turn and walk away. And so they reached a stage where they would not give me their problems, but work on them themselves. Then they got to what I think is the healthiest stage, where they would come and tell me their problems, so I would listen to them. That's all. And then they would understand what they should do. I wouldn't have an answer. But as the years have gone by, I began to learn answers. You see, that it's like saying love, you know, accept, forgive, join a group.
Right.
So now if they come with a problem and I say, well, what you need to do is get a therapist and join a group and love and accept, they'd say, you're no help. See, you didn't listen to me. You see, and it's so different, you know, because years ago they'd scream, okay, get a therapist, join a group, love and accept. Thank you. You know, and now they don't want to hear any of that. They just want somebody to listen to them.
Yeah.
And I have to keep reminding myself, because it's hard as a parent to not tell your kids how to straighten everything out.
Yeah.
But I was proud. One of them recently, a friend came in, cashed a check in his place of business for $150 and hadn't paid him back. And finally, I guess, I just called him the other day. I said, you know, what you need to do really is let go of that. Tell your friend, it's okay. I'm giving you a gift. And he had said to me that the friend had come in with $100, and he said to him, you know, if you can't really afford the $50, forget it, or I'll come over to your shop and, you know, we'll get $50 worth of whatever you're selling. And and I said, right, that's how you heal it. Because otherwise you sit home resenting this guy who took advantage of you,
starts creating a
in the middle of a busy day, cashing a personal check, you know, and not paying you back. And it's give the gift to the world and let it go, because ultimately it comes back manyfold.
Well, you've given it to yourself in that moment, too, because the resentment creates a biochemical change in your body that's destructive as well.
The one man, I always use his quote, he sat in my office because I talk about, you know, love, accept, forgive, and he said, my brother-in-law is an SOB who ruined the family business, so he's an exception to your rule of love and forgiveness. And I said, but what do you do in your family when you carry that resentment in your brother-in-law? You know, and we began to talk about if you have a bar mitzvah or a wedding or a family affair, he can't go if his brother-in-law is going. The two sisters can't talk to each other because the husbands are mad at each other. And I said, you're killing yourself with all this wasted energy. You know, either let go of your brother-in-law, love your brother-in-law. I mean, there are a lot of solutions, but if you keep resenting and hating, you're in trouble.
You're the one who's in the most pain anyway. They are.
One thing that I also pops into my head when I mention that is, I think anger is appropriate at many times. Because to me, anger, Elizabeth Kubler Ross is the first one who brought that to my mind. She said, healthy anger, you know, it's like 20 seconds, you're done with it. I mean, that's when somebody steps on your toe, you know, you're being abused. Hey, speak up. That's like the assertive patient. But if you don't speak up, that's the resentment and hatred. See, that's what turns out, I think, a Hitler or Hussein. I mean, yeah. It's never been expressed. You never had a chance to get it out in a healthy way. And so it's taken out on everyone. And that's the sad part, that most of the world are lovers. There was one report I heard where men were taken into the army and asked if they were capable of killing. And approximately 85% say no. But you train. I mean, you can train people to kill to save their buddies. I mean, that's so you teach them how to kill. But if you understand that, obviously, then 15% of the world, in a sense, are capable of killing. And so it is a minority. And I think if we continue to love, that minority will get smaller and smaller and smaller and really not be able to destroy the world because there's so many lovers around. Yeah.
Oh, we have access to what we utilize on a regular basis. When you don't use, you lose. Something that would be useful for us not to use.
A couple of quotes. One came from philosophy and religion in college, where some teacher said, St. Augustine said that in order to see, one must love. Mm-hmm. And I raised my hand and said, I thought love was blind. Teacher said that was the only smart thing he said in the whole year. But because, pre-medical student, philosophy and religion wasn't my big thing. But he said that because he said, I didn't have a good answer for you. And it took me a lot of years to have a good answer, because the truth is that lovers are open, see?
Yes.
And so they can see new things.
Yes.
And it's not the blind love, you know, of the individual, which is really the love for the self and that refuses to see, you know, back to relationships. But that lovers are willing to look at the world and be excited about it and see and experience new things. And I think that's a part that I was open to. The other is the movie Harold and Maude. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes.
But Ruth Gordon says, a lot of people enjoy being dead, but they're not dead really. They're just backing away from life. Reach out, take a chance, get hurt even, play as well as you can, go team go, give me an L, give me an I, give me a V, give me an E, live. Otherwise, you've got nothing to talk about in the locker room. Mm. Now, that, you see, if you go back into that, reach out, take a chance, get hurt even. But if you haven't had the support, you don't reach out. You don't take a chance. Because if you get hurt, it's painful.
Yeah.
And that's the part, you see, that you've got to break through that and really say, I'm going to reach out. I know a football player who died of leukemia, a wonderful young man. The team honored him because of his battle. And he said that, you know, when I was playing, I always thought I gave all I could on every play. But he said, now that I've graduated and have leukemia, I know I didn't. He said, I just wish I could go back, say, and have that chance again to give everything on every play. And he basically said to the team, go out and do that so you're not sorry later. And that's all you're asking of people. Give it all you got. You're not a failure. You're a winner if you participate, and you will affect your kids. Because if we teach how to deal with adversity and we teach how to deal with afflictions, then your kids know how to deal, see, and get redirected and go on living. But if it's God punishing you and you're a failure and then you crumble whenever you run into anything.
Yeah.
And I think this is a big part of the differences in the people in this world and what we see. Some who have made the choice to love and heal their whole family and to take on adversity, and others who have been supported, like Norman Vincent Peale's mother saying, if God slams one door further down the corridor, another opens. So, I mean, it's obvious Norman's going to write a book, The Power of Positive Thinking, because, you know, his mother created him.
That's true.
And I think this is the part that if you're really lucky and you have that mother, you may not appreciate it, you know, in the beginning, but boy, they make a big difference. That all parents are hypnotic, but not therapeutic. Hmm. And if we could make parents into hypnotherapists, I mean, I'd license parents and do a lot of things if I had my way.
Professional parents. You'd have to go through school before you had kids. Well, some parents, though, are that hypnotic, and they've said that, and it still fell on deaf ears. So we still ultimately control the choice. But I agree with you. We've got to have the references, but we can seek them out.
Because we're in incredibly powerful positions from the standpoint of why people come to us. But, you know, I get back to the elevator operator and the bus driver and the subway conductor and the hairdresser. I mean, they're in powerful positions, too, that if you have somebody in what I call a trapped situation in your elevator or bus and you choose to love them, you will change them, too. And you have that opportunity. So I think all of us have to see ourselves as elevator operators or bus drivers, that we're traveling with others. And if we give love, we will get love.
I mean, we have the opportunity to do it all the time.
Yeah, and we do. I mean,
it's not just when you're doing a seminar.
I mean, I keep thinking. No, we were driving down the street the other day in some strange city, and some poor lady is standing there holding a sign because they're working on the road. You know, it says "slow, danger ahead," and she slumped on this sign. And I leaned out the window and I said, "You do that with such beauty and grace. I've never seen anybody hold a sign like that before." And she stood up straight, beamed, and said, "That's my boss. Tell him." And I said, "I'll tell him you need a raise." And so we drove up and talked to her boss. But, I mean, I know I changed that lady's day. Now, it wasn't, you know, premeditated. I mean, I saw her, and I thought, this lady needs some love. And the people in the car look at me and laugh. I mean, they think, you know, here's this crazy. But the car felt better. She felt better, you know.
Yeah, we're kindred spirits. I do that all
and
the time.
I think that when we see that and just say those few words.
But it also, the other person who gets rewarded, the truth is you. Because you know you're being who you really are.
Yeah.
You're living your life's purpose when you're doing those things. Yeah. It's not just when you're being a surgeon. You've got an opportunity to do it every moment. When you make the sandwich, you've got a chance to do it.
And I think it's a lot of times our kids would say, "We don't want to go out to eat with you because we never know what you're going to say when somebody comes up and says, 'May I help you?'" You know. And so for the kids, it was embarrassing. Now they've outgrown that. But Bobby, too, you know, we do a lot of outrageous things. But it's part of how I try to explain to people that humor is the most important part of survivors. And that when somebody really says, "May I help you? Are you willing to say, 'I'm on medication and my therapist is doing the best he can?'" If you sign into hotels, you have to try this now. Either it says either firm or company. If it says firm, I lean over the counter and say, "Am I?" And they say, "Are you what?" I say, "Am I firm? How do I know how to fill this in?" Say, and if they refuse to squeeze me, I just write "yes" in. And if it says company, I say, "Yes, my wife is with me." You know, it's that kind of craziness, what I call the child in you, that most of us won't liberate the kid and let the kid live because the kid sees life differently. And if the kid comes to the front, you always seem to manage through the pain. Even my father, he's quite ill now. He's on prednisone. But he said, "God, if I could just get off this Prestone, I'd feel better." And, I mean, how can you not laugh, you know? I mean, and use that.
My personal belief in life is that that everybody's got a little kid inside, and they're just begging to come out and play. And if you're willing to come out and play first, they'll jump out a lot faster.
Right.
And I think that's really the direction of healing for everybody, is let that kid come out and play more.
It you know, it's part of why I think at our workshops, that with Bobby there and my wife, we forget. We've been together so long, we forget the audience is there. And so we have an interchange as if we're sitting in the kitchen. And people kind of get such a kick out of that and begin to laugh. And then I realize, oops, there's 1,000 or 2,000 people here. But I think it's healthy, you know, to forget the world. I mean, you can't keep performing because of what people expect or how they're looking at you, but to just be yourself. And for most people, that's hard to be. They're not sure who they are. That's what I say. They don't know their own happiness, their own path. To find that. And I think, again, what I get back to many times, I was thinking of a college student, medical students. I just asked a lady who mentioned several occupations. She wasn't sure what she should be. I say, draw yourself in each occupation. And it's very obvious when you look at, should I be a politician, a school teacher, a doctor, or whatever, or what college I should go to? It becomes very obvious as they draw, you know, say a school in New York and in California, and where they will feel good. And this one young student happened to be going into the theater. So when is she on the stage alone? You know, what does it look like around her?
Yeah.
And you could say to her, that's the college that really is best for you. And that's that her information, that intuitive part, you know, that might come out in a dream, but you can look at on the piece of paper and say, that's really where you belong. And that's the part I think also the child is in touch with. It's the feelings, the intuitive. God speaks in dreams and symbols, the Bible tells us. And I think we really need to be in touch with that.
Yeah, and trust it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, without a doubt. Coming back to that, we were talking a little bit earlier about the whole idea that there's a great quote in your book that says, I think it's from an associate of yours, saying, if you don't believe in miracles, then you're not practical.
Right.
And coming back to the practical miracle of our bodies and what we can do just by changing our thoughts, I think it'd be really neat if you could share a few examples of some of those miracles that seem to be absolutely impossible and how people have turned around. I know, for example, I believe you listed it in your book, and I've read many studies where they've taken people with multiple personalities and they find out that there's a totally different physiological effect of the same environment. They have allergies in one personality and they don't another, or they have physically a burn, a physical lesion in one personality, and they change personalities and the lesion literally disappears from their body. I mean, these are facts.
I know.
So and maybe you could give us some of those elements and, also.
Well, I think this is part of why I said that I try to get people on their path. It's like letting the old self die and a new self come, and that the new self rejects the old disease, and that you're seeing this in an extreme form in multiple personalities where people switch personalities and have diseases literally. I think in one case, diabetes in one personality, not in another.
Yes.
Even things like cataracts, eye colors, I mean, glasses. Oh, one lady wrote and said that she keeps like 6 or 7 pairs of glasses in her bedside stand because she doesn't know who she'll be in the morning when she wakes up. And I don't know if you remember that, also that story, I was speaking to my wife when I say you remember, where a lady said she was drunk at a party and her friends wouldn't let her go home. She was a multiple. She said, oh, I won't drive. One of the others will. They wouldn't let me. And so she could switch personalities and no longer be intoxicated.
And her biochemistry literally changes right there.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Now, that's the power of the mind.
One of the persons I always think of, the gentleman John Florio that I started my second book with, because he's a friend and has just written a little story about his life. He's a landscape gardener, and it was just this time of the year, the spring. And he had extensive cancer. I've operated on him. He was filled with cancer that I couldn't remove all of it. And the path report is no mistake. It's there. But John's comments were, it's springtime. I'm too busy for your treatments. I have to go home and make the world beautiful, see? And that was basically his attitude. So he refused all further therapy, went home, and for the last 7 years has made the world beautiful. There's not a trace of cancer in his body. He's absolutely healthy today. And yeah, he's a miracle, but he's a miracle because he was making the world beautiful. He's just loving the world. It had nothing to do with not dying.
Yes.
Absolutely not. Yes. I mean, it was just his choice. Rather than work harder at living, I'd rather go home and make the world beautiful. Matter of fact, the only other appointment he had to the office was one day he came in, and when the nurse gave me his record, I thought she pulled the wrong record out because I thought he was dead. He hadn't come back to the office for 4 years. And I said, there must be two people with the same name. She said, no, he's sitting in there. So I went in. I said, what happened? He said, oh, I have a hernia from lifting boulders in my landscape business. So that was the only reason he came back. And now we see John. It's more to visit him, or he mails us something, you know, like his book about his life. And it really has to do with just transforming the world. What John did for me was make me see things I never saw before.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of wildflowers out there that I would walk by and never notice. And now they're beautiful and they catch my eye. And that's why I love things like running in the morning or going out in nature. It's easy for me to see why Indians would be spiritual, because they're out there. You're listening. You're hearing.
Yeah.
You meet a deer in the morning. And I had a wonderful experience. I think this is part of why you live. You know, a mother and her baby deer. The mother got scared and ran, and the baby just stopped and stared at me. And I really had a sense that the baby was saying, wow, here's a funny looking thing running down the street. And when I get back to the family, I have to tell them I saw a person today. Because, you know, I mean, the way I felt.
That's,
you know,
right.
I'm going to tell people. And the baby stood there, and I ran right up to her, and we just stared in each other's eyes. And the mother was standing in the woods kind of nervously, and we just looked at each other for a while, and then she went and I went on running. But I think those are the moments, you know, that are important. See, that word moment comes back again, that leads to our survival. And when you keep your journal, as I say, write the moments down that help you live, not the ones that are only painful. You won't forget those. But on the other hand, I can also remember how well, you see, when you talk about, in a sense, we're all multiples, because when I started keeping a journal, I would make little notes during the day. But when I sat down at night, I couldn't remember what the notes were about. And I realized how efficient my mind was at blocking out the things that were painful. Now, I knew they were in me, but I couldn't remember them. And so I started making more elaborate notes so I wouldn't let go of it and would really, you know, be able to deal with it.
Well, the thing is that sometimes we aren't just blocking it, we're just forgetting it, because also many times people can't remember the good things that were there. Maybe we need to do is keep
Well, it's that selective memory,
yeah,
as
I said.
If you ask your children, they will all have a different opinion of you because they all have selective memories. And we have twins, and they went through the same events, but they remember things very differently.
Yeah. Maybe the key to life is memory management.
Yeah. You know? Well, see, the optimist, I meant to say this to you earlier, Pessimists have a more accurate view of the world, but don't live as long and aren't as healthy. And optimists are less accurate, but a lot healthier. Yeah. So it is, in a sense, seeing the experience in a specific way.
Yes.
So that when I say the pessimist is more accurate, I mean, if there were certain events and tragedies happened, they'll know how many people died and how many days it lasted. But their interpretation of it is what's wearing them out. And yeah. The optimist may be less accurate about the event, but is using it in a very different way, and hopefully what will come of the event.
Bernie, I know that when you have a patient come to be with you initially, and you know that they have a dis-ease, whatever it is, a life-threatening one, that there are a series of questions you ask people,
right.
And that part of that is because you want to understand the meaning they hold
right.
for the disease. And also, I know that you also talk with people about the fact that many times diseases are there because they're filling an emotional need. Maybe you could tell us a few of the questions and give us some idea of that.
We mentioned earlier, do you want to live to be 100 and those issues? What's happened the year or two before you became ill? I think what a disease means to a family is important in a sense of, you know, mother, grandmother, or father, grandfather had that disease, then it may mean death, or it may mean something you fight.
Meaning because of what somebody else has
done,
they
believe
that.
How they have taken on adversity, they're passing to their children.
Yeah.
I also ask what benefits you may derive from an illness, because
now, don't people get upset with that, though?
Well, they do. They get mad because they think you're saying that they want it, but the want may be an unconscious desire in the sense of fulfilling a need that they have, and that the disease gives them permission to quit a job, to straighten out a marriage, to pick up the violin, whatever it is. So what I'm asking people to do is not need the disease, get the benefits. You see, one lady said it very well. When she said she was very sick and had a very difficult life, I said, go back to your housing project for the elderly and find somebody sicker with more troubles, give them love, watch what it does for you. And she came back and said, I went through the whole project, there's nobody sicker with more troubles than me. Now, I think for that lady, or the lady who said I was born unlovable and the only ones who touched me were doctors, that if I don't replace, you see, what the disease did for them, they're never going to give it up. Yeah. So I have to find another way for them to relate to people, something to talk about besides illness or for manipulating families or getting out of a job, and to get people to look at that. Now, if somebody's answer to that question is, I have no benefits, okay, drop it. I mean, you don't have to feel guilty or get mad at me. Drop it. I'm asking you to look at it.
Yeah.
And then the last question was, how do you describe your disease? What are the metaphors? And that includes divorce, headache, cancer, AIDS. I mean, it doesn't matter. Always look at how you describe your backache, so that why does one person have a knife in their back and another a great pressure and a weight and a burden and all these things? And then say, how do these words fit my life? And you always help yourself heal your life. So that when somebody says cancer's painful and invisible, I ask them to look at the painful things that they're hiding in their life. And that helps them heal the life and come out of it with some benefits and gifts.
Can changing a person's metaphor, if they do it themselves, if they really own a new metaphor, can that change their biochemistry? Like if they go from...
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, when I meet a friend of ours, Nick Horn, who's a state senator in Nevada, and he says, cancer is a blessing and a gift and a challenge to discover what's important about life. He told every state senator in Nevada he loved them in a meeting of the state Senate.
Wow.
He said it changed 20 raging, bull-like, crusty senators into warm, caring, sensitive people. No one ever told them they loved them before. Hmm. And his metaphors are real and significant. And he's alive today because of his love. There's no question. I mean, in terms of, he's like John, you know, with lots of cancer, but the man is still here a couple of years later. Yeah. And one of the other keys he said was, see, one of his first letters he said to me, and God willing, I'll be around to be reelected, see? Well, a year later, he is reelected, and he said, you know something? It isn't important. He said, I wanted power. Now it's given to me, and I don't care because I've learned what's important about life. And that's the difference, you see, and part of why Nick is around. And even in his campaign poster, he put in the word caring. And I think that gets back to how do you love the world?
Yeah.
When being a state senator is a way of loving the world, it's an entirely different
role. What has a richness to
role.
It?
Yeah. See, he's not living to be reelected. He's living to love.
Yeah.
And so he's out hunting with his kids, doing things, living, not afraid to say no, you know, to other people, and teaching every state senator.
That's
last
fabulous.
Workshop I did out there, another state senator came with him who also has cancer, because he's obviously making an impact on those people and the way the Senate And we're getting some non-smoking laws passed in Nevada, which I call love yourself laws. I mean, see, we shouldn't need laws to not smoke and wear seat belts and a whole host of things. They're laws that really ought to read, please love yourself or you'll be fined or have a higher income tax bracket. See? but that's really, and Nevada is, see, it's interesting. Look at Utah and Nevada. They touch. Utah has the lowest in chronic diseases. Nevada has the highest. And you say, why? They're sharing the same air and soil and everything. Well, if you look at the culture, the religion, the family structure.
The beliefs and values.
Yep. Nutrition, all the things that go with it, you see why there's a difference in these states.
Yeah.
And that you have to bring in some of the self-love and attitudes and begin to deal with people in a way that makes them aware of their behavior and develop relationships and, you know, change some of these things.
That's fabulous. With AIDS, coming back to that, because that's the one that, like cancer, most people, they think of it and it means death to most people. And the minute people hear the word AIDS, they get depressed, which depresses their immune system, you know, biologically. What I've noticed is, I know you talk about AIDS patients that have turned themselves around. They're not only still alive today beating it, but literally they've turned the test around, but they still aren't considered cured because the medical profession doesn't have a definition for cure.
I know, that's changing. I see that in the medical literature a lot now.
What are they saying?
Like even imagery and meditation that used to be crazy are now indicated in certain cases.
Yes.
Well, I think what you're seeing, the word, there are many long-term survivors is now the way they're putting it, you know, with AIDS. And we do have people, as I said, around the country, I mean, many, many who have reversed blood tests, who have now been written up in medical journals, you see, saying they were supposed to die and they didn't. So they're documenting them and putting them down. Now, they may still say they're lucky, you know, and so it takes a lot for the doctor to finally sort of break that down because, you see, it's a way of our being hurt. If we get optimistic and hopeful and you don't make it, then we're hurt again. That's crazy. The optimism and the hope helps a person live. Nobody gets mad at you for giving them hope. As I said, the two letters you don't get about, you know, complaints about are, you gave me hope and you made me laugh. I mean, people don't get mad at you for that.
Yeah.
And doctors have to learn that. And with the hope, more people survive.
Yeah.
And I think this is what you see very much. It's even clearer in AIDS because there's less medication to confuse it.
Yes.
See, we can say you got better because we gave you chemotherapy and radiation, even though we told you they wouldn't work. but with AIDS, there's very little to get, you know, confused about in terms of medication.
Yeah.
So if somebody gets better, it's obvious they did it on their own.
Yeah.
And
but the key is letting them know they really are better, because if we don't have a criteria that says you're now better, then these people will
stay in
mental state.
Well, we keep waiting for the
But you see, if you keep asking the question, like, when am I going to get ill, or, you know, is this going to last, you create doubt, which then changes the biochemistry again.
Yeah, and a couple of times, even Ron said that when he would read an article about himself, and it was really, you know, the end of the article would say, but we expect him to get sick. If that would depress him, he'd begin to get symptoms, you know, feel sick again. And you have to keep fighting that. And that's why you need to have the assertiveness to get a doctor. You know, it's one of the questions you were asking before. If your doctor depresses you, get a new doctor. Okay? If a hug doesn't work and humor doesn't work and sincerity doesn't work, fire your doctor.
Yeah. Maybe the message is that every day we got to stand guard at the door of our mind and make sure that all the things going in there are the things that we're choosing to put in there rather than just letting other people put it in.
Right.
Yeah. What are the most important characteristics for someone who is really going to succeed, who's going to turn a disease around, just in a capsule form? What are the emotions that they need to cultivate? What are the beliefs they need to cultivate?
I think, number one, one lady said, using your four faiths, which means yourself, your spiritual faith, your physician, medications, in other words, your family. Don't leave anything out.
Yes.
You say, use all your resources, because as soon as you limit your resources to God or the doctor or whatever, or yourself, you're eliminating possibilities. So I keep the doors open. I would also take charge of my life, that I will make choices about what feels right for me at this moment.
Yes.
For instance, why we named our cat Miracle had to do with a dream a lady had, asking for guidance as to whether to accept further therapy or not. And a cat appeared, and she said, "What's your name?" Cat said, "Miracle." She said, "Okay, I know I don't need any more treatment." And 8 years later, she tells this story. But she also said, if I needed more treatment, and it seemed appropriate, I'd go back and get it tomorrow.
Yes.
I was looking for what was right for me in my life at that moment.
Yes.
So we use a lot of dreams to help people make decisions about therapy and choices in their life. But making choices, I think, and taking responsibility is probably the key. Yes. Humor is a part of these people. Living in the moment, as I mentioned, being willing to share feelings, to use their pain to help others, what I would call service to the world, because a lot of long-term AIDS survivors are helping other people with AIDS and wondering why they're all right. And these other, you know, as one man said, go from the cemetery to the hospital. Why am I all right? Well, he's busy loving all those people in a sense, and that's part of why he's going on. Al Siebert, who was a... in the service, and he said he noticed many of the survivors that were his teachers, you know, the sergeants and so forth, had certain personality characteristics, which included humor. You know, it's like, hey, next time if you don't keep your head down, you won't have a head, you know, but they would chuckle as they said it.
Right.
And he realized that there were personality characteristics of survivors. So he has written a little book on these characteristics. But it really gets back to all the things we've talked about.
Yes.
How you deal with the events, you see, how you deal with the moment. Do you see humor about survival, about using the pain and all the issues that go with it? Being assertive at one time and maybe even submissive in another. What he learned was they could fit the circumstance.
They were flexible.
They could be very mature, right, at one moment and very childlike at another, so that they were. They weren't rigid, fixed in any specific pattern. And that's what made them survivors.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes
and sense. If you see, if you really want to know about survival, let's say, read about cancer patients, read about people who got out of concentration camps, made it off life rafts. I mean, they're all telling you the same thing, which is an attitude towards life. And that includes the spiritual aspects and a whole host of other things.
Yeah. When I talked to you before we turned on this tape, you said something I really loved. You said that maybe the question in life is, what do I want to give love to in the world, or how do I want to give love to the world? Would you just maybe amplify that for a moment for
us? Well, I think that if you make that, Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss, you see, and that if you climb the ladder of success and it's leaning against the wrong wall, you're in big trouble. And so if you learn how you want to give love to the world, it allows you to do it in many ways. I mean, I mentioned to you the characteristics that led me to being a surgeon. Could lead me to run a restaurant, gas station.
I mean, it doesn't matter.
Because the same things are there.
Yes.
I always remember Larry Lachon asking a man, what do you want to do with your life? See, I started asking people also, what do you want to be when you graduate from high school, no matter what age they are, to get them in touch with these feelings. And the man said, I'd like to be a doctor. He was in his 60s. He said, but that's highly, you know, impractical. He said, well, what does being a doctor mean to you? And he said, well, you have an office. People come in, you make them feel better, they go out. They got him a job in a roadside stand on a parkway for tourists. So they come in, he tells them how to have a nice vacation, they go out, see? And that was something for him.
Yes.
A gang leader, see, who said, life was exciting, and the gang broke up and I have cancer. They got him in the fire department because it meant excitement, sitting with other men. You know, he was, and he survives again, responds to treatment. So it is looking at what your personality characteristics are and saying, how do I want to contribute to the world?
Yeah.
If you're contributing love to the world, then you get up loving what you want to do each day, and you don't have to have your heart attack Monday morning.
Yeah.
And you don't have to someday say, I made nuclear weapons for 15 years, I hated it, and then get cancer, and then buy a house in the mountains of Colorado and quit your job.
Yeah.
Say, I'd rather you move to Colorado now and find how to give love from the mountains of Colorado. Become a tourist guide, you know?
Right.
But give yourself permission to do that before somebody says you're going to be dead.
Well, you've certainly done that, and you've helped a lot of people to be able to do that on a massive scale. How do you want to be remembered? I'm curious.
I forgot what I wanted on my stone.
Well, it doesn't have to be on the stone.
How do I want to be remembered?
Yeah.
For somebody who tried and who loved. See, part of what I know is I am not perfect. You know what I mean? I'm still working on me.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I think keeps me helpful to others, that I have a lot of imperfections that I work on. And by continuing to use them, you know, I help others. So you might say the epitaph could be, he had a lot of imperfections, but he was a nice guy. you know, and even his wife and kids will tell you that. I think they would, see?
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing that I pick out more than anything is the music I want played at my funeral. I always tell everybody to do that. Things like Amazing Grace, Imagine by the Beatles, Danny Boy, a song called Vincent. I don't know if you know all those numbers, but I think if you knew those songs, you'd know something about what I'm like, you know, that it's continually reaching and trying and doing all those things. I'm probably too full of energy, you know. It's like there are 6 or 8 occupations that I'd like to have, so that it's hard to slow down. And as Bobby knows, she gets sort of swept along with me, but makes it, you know, me capable of doing that too.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing the music of your soul, because I'm sure it is stirring many people, and hopefully through this tape that'll happen even more. And I thank you for the privilege of your presence.
Thanks, Tony.
You're a wonderful human being.
Thanks.